Hello everyone, welcome to the reading of the Ford Dodge Messenger for Tuesday, April 20th. I'm Kevin Rogers at the microphone, glad to have you listening as always. It's kind of a coolish day in Fort Dodge. The sunshine has come out here in the latter part of the day. That's always good to see. I think we have another cool day or two ahead of us, and then finally we'll see some warm-up. Some friends of mine who farm are talking about finally getting into the fields this coming weekend. And I know several other farmers who have already been hard at work. So, busy time of year for them. In the meantime, looking at the messenger, the first story that they have here for us is the vital news that a section of South 25th Street will close. Several blocks of South 25th Street will be closed to traffic this week. South 25th Street between 5th and 8th Avenue South will be closed. Beginning Wednesday, South 25th Street from 5th Avenue South to the southernmost entrance to the Crossroads Mall property will be closed for sanitary sewer repair work and concrete patching. That section will remain closed until Monday. A different view of the world is the title of the next article, Facing Autism Hosts Awareness Event at Dodger Stadium. About 3 years ago, Allison Drew's son, Elliot, was diagnosed with autism at age 4. Then in July 2020, her daughter, Evelyn, age 4, was diagnosed with the same developmental disorder. Autism impacts a person's ability to communicate with others. It affects 1 in 54 children, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. One of the ways Drew is moving forward is through a nonprofit organization called Facing Autism Incorporated. The group formed in 2018. Its co-directors are Drew and Janelle Lincoln, both of Fort Dodge. We are a group of parents that came together and wanted to improve the lives of our children and other children with special needs, Lincoln said. I learned about the group and joined, Drew said. One of the ways I coped with the diagnosis was to jump in and learn. On Saturday at Dodger Stadium, Facing Autism hosted an awareness walk. About 50 people attended. Drew said the organization has been a healthy way to examine the challenges of autism while bringing awareness to the disorder. It's been a positive way to deal with the news of a diagnosis, she said, but also a way to educate others. Drew said there are different levels of autism, and the disorder can affect each person differently. Her son, for example, doesn't require as much support as her daughter. He's very intelligent and independent, Drew said. She struggles with communication and has certain sensory issues. They don't like big crowds. Despite a unique set of challenges in raising her children, Drew said they have impacted her life positively. Autism definitely has its challenges and difficulties, but it's been a good journey for me as a mom. I've learned a lot from my kids on how to view the world differently. It's not as devastating as people think. It's been an honor to raise them and learn from them. Lincoln's son, Dylan, 15, lives with autism. When Dylan was 2, he wasn't talking and experienced some delays in areas like walking, she said. He was eventually diagnosed through the school system. Since that time, Lincoln has taken him to different specialists who provide a range of therapies, interventions, and techniques. Speech therapy is huge, occupational therapy, physical therapy. Dylan used what's called Dynavox to help him communicate. I can best compare it to an iPad with a communication app, said Lincoln. He also uses sign language. The biggest challenge is understanding him and what he needs and what he wants. She said he uses a small amount of words. If he has a stomach ache, he can use that machine to tell us he has a stomach ache, Lincoln said. He uses sign language. He kind of made up his own. People closest to him understand it, but you can't take a sign language class and know what he's doing. They are ones he's developed. That's the part that is hard for me to explain to people. Dylan is nonverbal and doesn't talk, and you'll meet another child who can talk quite well. Some people might be more affected by certain things than others. Lincoln, who also works with other families who have special needs, said getting her son the services he needs has been a huge challenge. That was a challenge and still is, she said. We have a lack of services in our area, and it can be very frustrating. There's improvements, and I know different agencies are working on it. But as a parent, you want to make change happen instead of waiting around for someone to save you. Lincoln said applied behavioral analysis is one key service missing in Fort Dodge. In Iowa, it is very difficult to access this therapy, she said. The others we have closer to home, you can get speech, occupational, and some kids do feeding, but you can get those, but ABA is very difficult to do. She said the closest providers of ABA are in Ames, Waterloo, and Mason City. We do have one agency, Developmental Wellness, that has served the Fort Dodge area, but it's kind of a private agency, Lincoln said. I haven't personally used them. There are limited agencies that provide it here, and part of it is the cost. One Vision, a nonprofit organization that provides employment support for individuals with disabilities and other needs, at one point had plans to open a children's autism center. That center would offer ABA, Lincoln said. Lincoln hopes to bring a greater level of understanding to the community through Facing Autism. I think understanding that autism is lifelong and that there's a spectrum, she said. We have kids that are very mildly affected and go into a regular classroom. They don't grow out of the symptoms, but learn to manage them better. Others need more support. It's hard to be different, and this just gives us a platform to educate people. Honoring a Rich Tradition will be the title of the next article that we read. Fort Dodge Senior High will present its 94th annual musical. With a vision to recognize the time-honored local tradition of musical theater, Fort Dodge Senior High will continue its showcases, the longest-running high school musical in the nation, with its 94th consecutive performance, honoring a rich tradition this week. The idea is to highlight and honor the rich history of excellence in music theater here in Fort Dodge, by incorporating and performing songs for musicals that Fort Dodge Senior High has performed in the past, said choir instructor Matt Dries, who will again direct this cabaret-style performance. We looked at the list of shows and tried to start with performances that had been staged more than once. From there, we tried to create a few different categories of songs that we were looking for in terms of full company, men's ensemble, male solo, female solo. Once we began to work on that list of songs, we wanted to look at the students who were involved and try to find ways to feature them as best as possible. It took a while to comb through the shows and select some songs that would work, but once we had a solid list, we just built from there, and the show started to take shape. Senior High will perform at the Fort Dodge Middle School this Thursday through Saturday using a cabaret format to safely continue its legacy through a global pandemic. From the beginning of the planning process, we wanted to find a way to be able to have the students perform while still following COVID safety guidelines, Dries said. We settled on a cabaret format as a way for students to still experience the thrill of live performance while giving us the flexibility to limit and control the number of students on stage or at rehearsal at any given time. Our students will perform wearing masks, and we have set the stage up to include more than one location where different acts will be happening. Additionally, the cabaret format allows us to have students perform songs as solos, duets, trios, and quartets. Instead of the full group performing at the same time, our student instrumentalists have recorded their instrument parts that will be used as accompaniment tracks for the singers during the performance. The musical tradition at Fort Dodge Senior High started in 1928 with the staging of The Marriage of Nanette. One of the really neat parts about our program is a page that lists chronologically every year and shows that has been performed at Fort Dodge Senior High, Dries said. It's great to be able to see each of the years and reflect on that tradition. In some cases, we have students whose parents or even grandparents had part of musicals at Senior High. We have faculty who were part of musicals at Senior High. It is so neat to be able to connect to that history and highlight that incredible tradition. Last year, the students were unable to showcase their talents because of the pandemic. The stream of musicals continued, given students still went through the process and preparation before ultimately being kept off the stage due to COVID-19. Last year's musical, Bright Star, was the 93rd annual musical production presented by Senior High. Although our actual performances didn't happen, we still count it very much as part of this tradition. We paid royalties, cast roles, and students were preparing music, dialogue, blocking, and in some cases even choreography. Just because the performances didn't happen doesn't mean that students were not fully engaged in the process of staging a musical. The current crew of Dodger performers are excited to be back on the stage in a live setting. Just being able to see and hear the kids sing in the spring has been so much fun, said Dries, who is working on his 8th musical at senior high. Aside from the musical last spring, we also had spring choir concerts. State large group festivals, solo and ensemble festivals that did not happen. Being around the kids and watching them perform in these events has been such a joy and blessing in 2021. Parts of this year's musical cabaret have been formatted to highlight the students' talents as well as the rich history of the event at senior high. When you are staging a musical, you are very bound by the specific parts to be cast and music to be performed, Dries said. Staging a cabaret has allowed us to include more student solos and small groups. Our opening song is one I wrote specifically for these performances, Dries said. It's sort of a musical narrative about last spring when our students' worlds got turned upside down. I heard from many of them that what they missed most about being at school was their music classes. The chance to make music in community with others was suddenly absent in their lives. Our song included lyrics that students wrote and tells a story about the time in their lives. I just want to sing. I want to show the world there's a song inside of me. Heading back to the main page of the Messenger, we'll take a look for our next article. A Fort Dodge man has pleaded guilty to shooting another man with a flare gun. He has been sentenced to 20 years in prison for his crimes. William Goddard Jr., 32, was arrested on July 22, 2020, after he shot a 52-year-old man with a flare gun in the 500 block of South 15th Street the day before. In a video recording, Goddard Jr. was seen shooting twice at the man before pushing him to the ground, striking him with a blunt object numerous times. Before he left the crime scene, Goddard Jr. struck the victim lying on the ground with his vehicle. The victim, Robert Allen, was taken to Unity Point Health Trinity Regional Medical Center for a treatment of non-life-threatening injuries, including a fractured skull. Goddard Jr. was initially charged with attempted murder, a Class B felony, and going armed with intent. In January, Goddard Jr. pleaded guilty to intimidation with a dangerous weapon, a Class C felony, going armed with intent, a Class D felony, and willful injury, a Class C felony. The plea agreement also dropped several pending charges Goddard faced in unrelated incidents, including trespassing, reckless driving, theft, drug violations, driving while barred, vehicle registration violation, and no insurance. Goddard Jr. was sentenced by District Court Judge Kurt Stobey last week for the charges of intimidation with a dangerous weapon and willful injury. Stobey sentenced Goddard Jr. to 10 years in prison for each offense to be served consecutively. For the charge of going armed with intent, Goddard Jr. was sentenced to 5 years to be served concurrently to the other two sentences. Goddard Jr. also faces $4,329.75 in fines and surcharges, which were suspended due to his pending incarceration and lack of financial resources. Stobey also extended the no-contact order between Goddard Jr. and Allen for 5 years. Goddard Jr. will be taken to the Iowa Medical and Classification Center in Oakdale to end process for the Iowa Department of Corrections before he is transferred to a state prison to serve out his sentence. Fort Dodge man will serve a decade in prison. After pleading guilty to willful injury for stabbing a man in a downtown apartment in July 2020, Donathan L. Williams, 42, was sentenced to 10 years in prison. On Friday by District Court Judge Kurt Stobey, earlier in the week, Williams had pleaded guilty to willful injury causing serious injury, a Class C forcible felony, in exchange for two other charges being dismissed. Williams was arrested on July 2, 2020, after the victim, 39-year-old Laveris Bosworth, walked into the Community Health Center of Fort Dodge with wounds on his neck and back. Bosworth was transported to Unity Point Health Trinity Regional Medical Center for serious injuries. A criminal complaint for the incident said that Bosworth was stabbed after Williams followed him to his fifth-floor apartment in the Bitwell apartment building on North 10th Street. Williams was arrested and charged with attempted murder, a Class B felony, willful injury causing serious injury, going armed with intent, a Class D felony. Williams entered a plea deal with the prosecution and pleaded guilty to the willful injury charge, while the state dismissed the charges of attempted murder and going armed with intent. On Friday, Williams waived his right to have 15 days between the entry of the guilty plea and sentencing and requested to be sentenced immediately. In addition to the 10-year prison sentence, Williams was fined $1,575.50, which was suspended. He was also ordered to have no contact with Bosworth or any members of his family for the next 5 years. Williams will be transported to the Iowa Medical and Classification Center in Oakdale to be in process to the Iowa Department of Corrections before he is taken to a prison to serve out his sentence. Heading back to the main page of the Messenger, Drug Take Back Day is Friday. That will be the title of our next article. The United States Drug Enforcement Administration is holding its next Drug Take Back Day across the nation on Saturday. Locally, the event will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. on Friday at Daniel Pharmacy, 1114 Central Avenue. The DEA and its local partners will collect tablets, capsules, patches, and other solid forms of prescription drugs. Liquids, syringes, and other sharps and illegal drugs will not be accepted. The DEA does accept vaping devices and cartridges if the lithium batteries are removed. During the last take-back day in October, the DEA collected a record high amount of expired, unwanted, and unused prescription medications, with the public turning in close to 500 tons, according to a release from the DEA and Webster County Sheriff's Office. Since the start of the DEA take-back days 10 years ago, more than 6,800 tons of prescription drugs have been surrendered. According to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the U.S. saw 83,544 drug overdose deaths in the 12-month preceding ending July 1, 2020, the most ever recorded in a 12-month period, with studies indicating a majority of abused prescription drugs come from family and friends, including from home medicine cabinets. Clearing out unused medicine is essential, the DEA's release said. Take a look next at From Our Files. There's a picture of Humboldt's Sam Eichen as he clears the bar in the high jump during the Webster City Invitational. Eichen was second to St. Edmund's Josh Bradley in the event. This is From Our Files, April 2006. News of record for April 20th includes the Fort Dodge police logs from Friday. One domestic call, criminal mischief, 200 block of Avenue H. Unknown problem, 1300 block 5th Avenue South. Burglary in progress, 400 block South 14th Street. A car accident, 1500 block North 24th Street. Suspicious person, 200 block of Avenue D. Shoplifter, 1200 block 1st Avenue South. Juvenile problems were reported in the 1600 block of Fort Floral Avenue. Forgery, 3300 block 5th Avenue South. Suspicious person, 10 block North 12th Street. Unknown problem, 1300 block 5th Avenue South. Burning complaint, 2000 block 2nd Avenue North. Theft, 2100 block of 7th Avenue North. Mail tampering, 1800 block South 15th Street. Civil problem, 3100 block North 15th Street. Burglary in progress, 500 block 4th Avenue North. And a suspicious vehicle, 200 block Avenue E. On Saturday, one domestic call reported. Suspicious vehicle, South 17th Street, 12th Avenue South. Person with a gun, 10 block North 12th Street. Unknown problem near Central Avenue and North 11th Street. Hit and run, 3700 block 5th Avenue South. Suspicious person near 2nd Avenue North and North 15th Street. Missing juvenile reported in the 300 block of North 20th Street. Theft in the 800 block of South 16th Street. A fight in the 1800 block of 1st Avenue South. Trespassing, 900 block 3rd Avenue South. Theft in the 1500 block of 3rd Avenue Northwest. Water problems in the 500 block of South 25th Street. Hit and run, 1200 block 4th Avenue North. Trespassing, 900 block Central Avenue. Harassment, 100 block 5th Avenue North. Car accident, 800 block Kenyon Road. Unsupervised child reported near North 7th Street and 7th Avenue North. Criminal mischief, 100 block Central Avenue. Unknown problem, South 18th Street, 11th Avenue South. Another unknown problem, 3100 block North 15th Street. Seems to be a rash of unknown problems in town lately. Trespassing, 600 block South 18th Street. Juvenile problems, Avenue E and C Street. Also 1100 block 23rd Place North. Suspicious vehicle, 2nd Avenue South and South 12th Street. A suspicious vehicle. also in the 700 block of South 32nd Street. On Sunday, two domestic calls reported trespassing 10 block North 10th Street. Suspicious person, 7th Avenue North and North 4th Street. Theft near 4th Avenue South and South 17th Street. Suspicious vehicle, 10 block North 12th Street. Suspicious person, 1400 block Central Avenue. Theft, 700 block 1st Avenue South. Criminal mischief, 1000 block North 3rd Street. Gas drive off, 2300 block of North 15th Street. Car accident, 7th Avenue North and North 12th Street. Power outage reported in the South 17th, 12th Avenue South area. An assault in the 800 block of Kenyon Road. A burglary in progress, 900 block 3rd Avenue North. Loud party, 1000 block 4th Avenue South. Criminal mischief, 400 block of O Street. Civil problem, 300 block 3rd Street Northwest. Hit and run, 2000 block of Highway 169. Shoplifter, 10 block South 15th Street. Car accident, 500 block North 22nd Street. An unknown problem, 200 block North 10th Street. Car accident, 2500 block 5th Avenue South and North 16th Street and 6th Avenue North. Burglary, 600 block South 20th Street. A burglary, 1800 block 5th Avenue South. A fight, 2900 block 5th Avenue South. Harassment, near 11th Street and Central Avenue, loud party, 1000 block 4th Avenue South, trespassing, 1300 block 6th Avenue North, a burning complaint, 2400 block of Elmhurst Avenue, and a suspicious vehicle reported in the 700 block of South 29th Street. That is one busy Sunday for the police department. We'll turn to the Messenger opinion page. The importance of permanent tax relief is a column provided by Tim Cranebrink. Over the last year, a common economic tool at the national level was the distribution of government funds directly to most Americans. While those payments have temporary value in addressing short-term economic impacts, that policy does little to advance the goal of creating long-term economic growth in a pro-growth environment. Permanent tax relief for Iowa families and small businesses gives them certainty in their efforts to provide for their families, invest in a small business, and create or pursue new careers. Last week, the Iowa Senate passed Senate File 587, a major reform to property taxes and mental health funding in the state. The centerpiece of that legislation moves the cost of mental health from property taxes assessed at the local level to the state level. By moving the responsibility for funding the mental health system to the state level, this policy eliminates the mental health levy on property taxes. Iowa legislature has regularly undertaken efforts to reduce the property tax burden with credits and limits. However, the unrestrained rise in property values and local levy rates inevitably undermines any effort from the state to ease the property tax burden. The best way to offer some permanent property tax relief is to eliminate a levy. With the elimination of a levy, assessment increases have a smaller impact into the future, and taxpayers do not have to worry about taxes rising again. Senate File 587 included another permanent tax cut by, again, eliminating the triggers of the 2018 income tax cut. The most recent revenue projections have the state budget hitting one trigger but missing the other trigger by only a fraction of a percent. By eliminating those triggers, Iowa families and small businesses can confidently plan for future tax rates and tax policy. And that column is submitted by State Senator Tim Cranebrink, Republican of Fort Dodge, who represents Senate District 5. Turning over to the Webster City Daily Freeman Journal, about 20 Democrats from across Hamilton County on Sunday took part in the annual Odd Year County Caucus and Organizational Meeting. During the meetings at Shelter 2 at Briggswood Park, Central Committee officers were elected for 2 years terms. Those elected to serve are County Chair Kathy Dingman, Webster City, County Vice Chair Janet Adam, Webster City, Secretary Kathy Getting of Williams, Treasurer Julie Earsman of Stratford. New bylaws, which have been reviewed and revised by the Central Committee, were adopted as well. A majority of the meeting was spent talking about new directions and actions that could be implemented. A number of new actions around the themes of service and messaging were chosen that the Central Committee and volunteers will implement. The annual caucus and organizational meetings typically occur in March, but were delayed until they could be held outdoors when chances of pleasant weather were greater in efforts to reduce COVID risks. Sunday's timely warmer weather made the gamble worth the wait. Fuller Hall will move to spring hours next as part of the continuing plans to open up more and ease restrictions that were put in place last year as a result of the pandemic impacting the community. Laurie Flaws, Director of Recreation and Public Grounds, presented the plan to the council Monday night during its regular session. Flaws said the new spring hours will begin April 26th and will continue until June 4th when the facility begins its summer schedule. What this entails is we can let more people in. We can have 20 people in the gymnasium. These are all according to CDC guidelines for social distancing. We can have 10 people in the game room and 10 people in the TV area at one time. Floss said the facility will be open after school for students to drop in. We divided the week out by grades just to see how it works, he said. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, the facility will be available 7th through 12th graders from 3:30 to 5. Tuesday and Thursdays would be open from 3:30 to 5 for 2nd through 6th grade students. We can only have 40 at one time, he said. Saturdays and evening hours would be open to anyone with a cap of 40 each night. Keep in mind that the rest of the building is open too, he said. We've been averaging about 50 to 60 people a day using the cardio, weight room, the racquetball courts, and the swimming pool. Flaws said people will still be required to wear face masks in the building. Other than that, they just have to watch the social distance, he said. Fuller Hall will be open Monday through Thursday from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m., Friday 6 a.m. to 10 p.m., Saturday 7 a.m. to 10 p.m., and Sunday 1 to 9 p.m. Open swimming will be available Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 7 to 9 p.m., Saturday from 2 to 4 p.m., and 7 to 9 p.m. 20 swimmers are allowed in the pool at a time, he said. Mayor John Hawkins also brought up a possible cleanup drop-off day to be held late in the spring or early summer. Councilman Brian Miller said he had been in contact with the high school wrestling coaches to see if team members would be able to help volunteer with the event. He said he would also reach out to other teams and organizations at the school to gauge the interest in volunteering. The council members also discussed whether the event should be held on one day or over a two-day period. No date has been selected yet. In March, members of First Congregational United Church of Christ collected T-shirts and turned them into totes. A total of 240 bags were sewn and delivered to All Cultures Equal on Monday. The totes will be used to pass out groceries from the food bank. ACE, or ACE, regularly sees up to 70 families on any pickup days. You're listening to the Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. And now we will take a look at today's obituary page. Marjorie Lind Allen. Marjorie Lind Allen, 101, formerly of Fort Dodge, died Sunday, April 18th at Touchstone Healthcare Community in Sioux City. Service honoring Marjorie's life will be 11 a.m. Friday, April 23rd at Gunderson Funeral Chapel, with the Reverend Dan Call officiating. Interment will follow in North Lawn Cemetery. Family will greet friends from 10 a.m. until service time on Friday at Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services. Marjorie is survived by her daughters, Linda Walrod, Beth Anderson, daughter-in-law, Marcia Allen, 8 grandchildren, and 11 great-grandchildren. She was preceded in death by husband Melvin, son Roger, sister Mildred, and brother Charles. Parents, son-in-law Wayne Andy Anderson and grandson Kyle Anderson. Marjorie was born June 3, 1919 in Fort Dodge to Oscar and Edith Anderson. She attended school in Fort Dodge, graduating in 1937. She then worked for Fort Dodge Telephone Company for 3 years. Marjorie was united in marriage to Melvin Allen, her high school sweetheart, on August 24, 1940. In 1942, she joined her husband at Great Lakes Naval Base in Chicago, Illinois, where they lived for 2 years. In 1944, she returned to Fort Dodge, awaiting his return in 1945. They made their home in Fort Dodge. Marjorie worked for Fort Dodge Animal Health for 27 years in the data processing department, retiring in 1984. Marjorie was a lifelong member of Grace Lutheran Church and served as church secretary and as a Sunday school teacher. She was a longtime member of the Delta Theta Chi sorority. Doris Rollo. On April 17, 2021, Doris Rollo departed her loving family and friends at her current resident, Bickford of Davenport Senior Living Community. She was 88 years old. Even though her current address was Davenport, she was a lifelong resident of Fort Dodge and a parishioner of Holy Trinity Parish. Doris was the mother of 5 children, 11 grandchildren, 23 great-grandchildren, whom she loved each and every one very much. Family and friends are invited to join us celebrating Doris's life at 1 o'clock on Thursday, April 22nd, at Loffesweiler Funeral Home. Entombment will follow at the Chapel of Peace Mausoleum at North Lawn Cemetery. Visitation will be 1 hour prior at the funeral home. You can also attend with family and friends by watching the live stream of the funeral service on Loffesweiler's Facebook page. Doris was born in Olivia, Minnesota on November 30, 1932, the daughter of Verda and Arnold McClurg and the oldest of 6. As an optometric assistant for more than 30 years, she worked for Dr. Foreman and Dr. Mace. Her more recent assisting position was at Central Eye Care, being there for most of the years. It was at Central Eye Care she was known for her caring and hard work attitude. When Doris was not working, she enjoyed spending time with her adult children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren and selling Avon. You could tell she loved representing Avon and building her Avon business because she won many awards for selling and for staying with it for more than 33 years. It wasn't until 2019 when she decided she wanted to retire from her employment at Central Eye Care and Avon. She also loved baking cookies during the holidays, growing flowers, sewing, knitting, crochet, and anything she could craft. Doris won many awards for outfits she would make for dolls at Christmas time. Then the dolls would be donated to needy children. Doris was a member of Monica Mothers, Catholic Daughters, and the Iowa Optometric Association. She'll be sorely missed and survived by her children, Pam Harachita, Mike Rollo, Deb Uhlenkamp, Pat Rollo, Teresa McAndrew, 3 brothers, Don McClurg, Lester McClurg, and Arnold McClurg Jr., grandchildren, Pete, Andrea, Bryce, Jesse, Cody, Tony, Lisa, Blythe, Kyle, and Heather, many great-grandchildren, nieces, nephews, and a number of friends. She was preceded in death by her parents, her brother Ralph McClurg, her sister, Dolores Salzkorn, 2 grandsons, Scott Uhlenkamp and Sean Rollo. In lieu of flowers, if you like, donations can be made to Holy Trinity Parish in Doris's name. From Belmont, Terrell Baker. Funeral services for Terrell Baker will be 10:30 Monday at Ewing Funeral Home in Belmont. Visitation is 4 to 6 p.m. Sunday at Ewing Funeral Home and from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. on Monday. From Sac City, Michael Zeke Quarterman. Memorial services for Michael Zeke Quarterman will be 10:30 Friday at Farber and Ottoman Funeral Home in Sac City. Visitation is 5 to 8 p.m. Thursday at the funeral home. Farber Ottoman is in charge of arrangements. Harold J. Messerly. Harold J. Messerly, 85, of Fort Dodge, died Saturday, April 17th at the Paula J. Baber Hospice Home. Visitation is 5 to 7 Friday, April 23rd at Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services. A graveside service will be 11 a.m. Saturday, April 24th at North Lawn Cemetery. Harold J. Messerly was born August 15, 1935, to Kenneth and Marjorie Engelman Messerly in Fort Dodge. Harold served 2 years in the Army and 4 years in the Reserves. Harold was united in marriage to Bonnie Richards on October 15, 1955, at First United Methodist Church in Fort Dodge. He worked for 40 years as a journeyman electrician and was a member of the IBEW, the Fort Dodge Rifle and Pistol Club, and the NRA. Harold is survived by his wife of 65 and a half years, Bonnie, his brother Mark Messerly, his brother-in-law George Richards, and many nieces, nephews, and cousins. He was preceded in death by his parents, Kenneth and Marjorie, and his siblings, Patricia, Joanne, Margaret, and Robert. Memorials may be directed to the Humane Society of North Central Iowa. From Pocahontas, Melissa Botine. Melissa M. Botine, of 63, of Pocahontas, died Sunday, April 18th at her home near Pocahontas, surrounded by her family. Private funeral services are Friday, April 23rd at St. Peter Lutheran Church in Pocahontas. Burial will be in Summit Hill Cemetery. Public visitation is 4 to 6 Thursday, April 22nd at Powers Funeral Home in Pocahontas. Gerald Heslop. Gerald Heslop, 72, of Otho, died Sunday, April 18th at the Paula J. Baber Hospice Home in Fort Dodge. Private family graveside services will be held at Hartman Cemetery at Lehigh. Memorials may be directed to the family. Arrangements are with Bruce Funeral Home in Fort Dodge. From Humboldt, Jerry Earhart. A celebration of life for Jerry Earhart will be 11 a.m. Thursday at Zion Lutheran Church in Humboldt. Visitation is 9:30 to 11 o'clock Thursday at the church. Lent's Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. And that completes the obituary page for today. We're going to next head over to the sports section, and we'll take a look at what we have there. On the Move is the title of the first article. Messenger athletes are driven to succeed. Humboldt's Quentin Orr has competed on the Blue Oval before, never at the Drake Relays, though. The decorated Wildcat senior will compete in the historic event for the first time on Thursday, running in the 1600 and 3200 meter runs, as well as the distance medley relay for Humboldt. I was super excited to run at Drake my freshman season at State. I made it my goal to be able to compete there. It's the biggest stage there is, with only the best of the best getting in. At the state meet in his rookie campaign, he placed 12th in the 3200. As a sophomore at State, he was 8th in the 1600 and 3rd in the 3200 for Class 3A. I couldn't have qualified without my awesome teammates and coaches, Orr said. Indoors, I've had my teammates Trevor Jacobson pace the first 600, and Eric Whitrock helped me through the last 800 of 1600 when I ran a blue standard. Our coaches also got us into a meet in Indianola where I was able to blue standard in the 3200. Orr will also compete in the fourth leg of the distance medley relay. Cade Mattson, Kale Huntermark, and Eric Whitrock will precede him. We also ran really well in the distance medley, and I'm glad our coach loaded it up so we could run a good time, Orr said. With this being my only time racing at Drake, I'm super excited to represent my school and all the people who have helped me get to this point. I'm really excited to run my individual events, and I think I have a really good chance of doing well and running fast, but I'm most excited about the DMR. Eric is running the 400 and hands off to me. Having worked so hard with him for so many years, it's really rewarding to be in a relay with him, especially one that has a shot of holding the Drake Championship flag up after the race. This is also the first relay event I've run at a big meet, so I'm super excited for that. We've worked really hard and have a lot to prove, so I can't wait to get on the track and have fun and compete. Webster City also has a double event qualifier in J.J. Moore. The Lynx Junior enters with the fourth best throw in the shot put and 14th in the discus. The Wildcats quartet of Jordan Kuhn, Aiden Christensen, Troy Gearjets, and Cade Mattson are also in the shuttle hurdle relay. Mattson will also compete in the 110-meter hurdles. Other messenger athletes slated for action include Southeast Valley's Caleb Scott in the high jump, Manson Northwest Webster's Cale Collins in the 110 hurdles, Pocahontas area teammates Trey Ords in the 100, and Dane Johnson in the shot put. Greene County's Jackson Morton is in the 110, Bryce Stalder is in the long jump, Nathan Black in the high jump will also compete on the Blue Oval. The high school portion of the Drake Relays will take place on Thursday and air live via Mediacom channel MC22. There will also be a live stream on runnerspace.com. A new perspective, Webster City grad McKinney bounces back to help Tritons reach nationals, is the title of the next article. Like so many around the country, Taylor McKinney missed out on several normal parts of college life this year. The former Webster City High School standout was dealt another difficult hill after suffering concussions during her first season with the Iowa Central women's basketball team. McKinney has since recovered and will compete along her teammates at the NJCAA Division II National Tournament being held in Hickory, North Carolina. The Tritons advanced to the quarterfinals after McComb was forced out due to COVID-19. The injury left the always active McKinney on the sidelines for 5 years. Coming back was such a long process, she said. Not only did I miss those games, but I felt like I missed out on a lot, team-wise. The most difficult part was knowing how long I was going to be out and how much time it would take to bounce back from that kind of injury. It is something that was hard both mentally and physically to get back from. McKinney enters the week averaging just under 4 points, an assist and a steal per game for the Tritons. After starting the season only 4-7, the Tritons have found a rhythm as a group, winning 7 in a row and 8 of their last 9, highlighted by an upset victory over nationally ranked DMAC in the regional final. That burst happened right at the time McKinney returned to the court. One of the big things we've said all season as a team is we have a ton of potential to do great things, McKinney said. Even after our losses early in the year, we never gave up. It was more of how can we turn this season around and get back on the winning track. That all started with our win on the road at Southeastern, which was actually my very first game back from my concussion. From there, we kept our heads high and focused on one game at a time. Iowa Central will be the number 12 seed in the 16-team tournament. They finished third overall in the ICCAC this year. Going to nationals with this team is something we worked so hard for since August, McKinney said. As a freshman, it doesn't get much better than that. This team deserves every bit of it, and I'm so proud of each and every one of them. The Tritons play at 8 o'clock Thursday, hosting either Grand Rapids, Michigan, or Johnson County, Kansas. The Iowa Central track program had a strong weekend, at the Mustang Open, hosted by Mount Mercy in Cedar Rapids. The Triton men set several meet records, qualified 5 more events for nationals, and picked up the team title along the way with 167 points. Iowa Central women finished as the top junior college, placing 4th overall and qualifying 1 more for nationals. On the men's side, Dashnell Dyer in the 100, Tristan Hanna in the triple jump, and the trio of Hunter Klimek, Chris Laverio, and Noah Frisky in the 10,000 all punched bids to the upcoming NJCAA Outdoor Track and Field Championships. Josie Stackus secured a post in the women's 10,000. Our squad competed well, again, said Iowa Central head coach Jordan Burkholder. We had 4 new national qualifiers in the 10,000 in addition to a bunch of personal records across several events. I'm excited to see how the competitions at our upcoming meets pushes our students. Jaheim Hales broke the 110 hurdles record to place first. Dyer did the same in the 100 with Robin Aguilar Gonzalez in the 800, Ari Scott in the long jump, Hannah in the triple jump, and David Grimaldo Vasquez in the high jump, also claiming first place medals. Jerome Jessup, Hales, Lee Eppy, and Dyer won the 4x100 in a meet record time of 40.72. Klimek was the 10,000 runner-up. Cassius Havas placed second in the 800. Elliot Cummings was second in the long jump, and the 4x400 secured silver. Liberio was third in the 10,000. It was a big day for the Tritons, Executive Director D. Brown said. We had some great competitions in the field events and on the track. We had some girls make their debut in the javelin and long jump while the throwers battled in the hammer. Tristan had a huge breakthrough in the triple jump, and our 10,000 kids were outstanding. Not only do we get 4 national qualifiers in the 10,000, but everyone ran outside their comfort zone for 25 laps and exceeded expectations. Hannah Connell set a new meet and facility record in the 100, clocking a time of 11.49 in the prelims. She won the race with a time of 11.56 in the finals. Lila Alvarez captured the 3,000 steeplechase in a meet record time. Victoria Adu broke the record in the hammer with a throw. And Ashley Michaud claimed the shot putt. Michaud was also second in the hammer. And Kia Wolf, the runner-up in the 100 hurdles. Stackus placed third in the 10,000. And Wolf third in the 100 hurdles. Iowa Central will compete later this week at the Drake Relays, followed by regional championships beginning soon. The Fort Dodge girls golf squad is focused on the big picture as the Dodgers work their way through the early stages of the 2021 season. Fifth-year head coach Dave Luck is preaching patience with his team, which is still making up for lost time after missing all of last year. Fort Dodge Senior High is trying to get better each and every day, hoping that the finished product in May will look much different than the early stages of the spring. I think the long-term outlook is positive, Luke said. The kids are very coachable and working hard. I can't fault their effort at all. They want to get better, but golf, that takes a pretty big commitment, and you don't always see immediate results. The important thing at this point is knowing they have the right attitude and develop a passion for good habits both on and off the course. Senior Maddie Major and juniors Michaela Newsom and Alexis Kenny returned with varsity experience. All three were regulars in the lineup two seasons ago. Missing out on competitive golf during this stretch has us behind where we would be otherwise, Luke said. The key is to get our feel back in the short game and around the green. That's where you score. Maddie is very organized and a really solid leader for our program. Michaela and Alexis both have high ceilings. If we can continue to build their confidence through physical repetition and the right mental approach, they have a lot of room still to grow. Sophomore Kennedy Bailey is settling into a consistent role while sharing time with the Dodgers soccer program. Classmates Kaylin Gilliland, Alicia Strain, and Kyla Ganzeveld are all making progress as well, according to Luke. That sophomore class could really have an impact here before all is said and done, Luke said. Again, it's just a matter of putting in the time now. We continue to emphasize the fundamentals and also the fact that every stroke, whether it's a drive, iron shot, chip, or putt, is worth the same and adds up. You can't waste any. Our lineup is going to be fluid for a while. Everyone is going to have the opportunity to step up and earn their spot. Sophomore Heidi Clay joins freshman Regan Grossnickel and Carson Zier in the junior varsity lineup. Luke said they're all giving me their best, aren't too far off. It's just a matter of honing their skills and turning their athleticism into results on the course through a better understanding of the swing and the game in general. Luke will again be assisted by Ryan O'Leary. Their schedule, they're to open today, April 20th, at Mason City, and they host the Fort Dodge Invitational on May 14th. The Emily Markert Coed Relays brought together a handful of teams from around the area Thursday night to the Keith Hart Athletic Complex. In the boys' standing, ACGC finished ahead of St. Edmund with Pocahontas Area. South Hamilton, OABCIG, and Manson Northwest Webster rounding out the top six. Newell Fonda, South Central Calhoun, East Sac County, Southeast Webster, West Bend Mallard, and MVA OCOU competed in the 12-team event. South Hamilton was crowned the team champion on the girls' side ahead of the host Cougars, with Pocahontas Area, Southeast Valley, and St. Edmund to follow. Manson Northwest Webster's Dayton Snell claimed the 110 hurdles, with Cougar Shuttle Hurdle Relay also earning first. For St. Edmund, both the 4x8 and 4x400 relays were winners. South Central Calhoun's Cole Corey and Pocahontas' area Trey Olertz won two events. Corey was first in the high jump and 400 hurdles, while Olertz won both the 100 and 200. The Indians were also the winners in the 4x2 and 4x100 relays, with that Southeast Valley's Sam Harrison claiming the long jump. Maddie Moline was a double winner for the Cougars, claiming both the 3,000 and 1,500. Manson Northwest Webster also won the shuttle hurdle relay. Avery Gallis picked up gold in the 200, and the Gales won the distance medley relay. Kirsten Fisher won three events for Southeast Valley, placing first in the high jump, 100 hurdles, and the long jump. Bailey Severs from Newell Fonda won the 800, and the Mustangs also claimed first in the 4x800, while Morgan Devereaux was the shot put winner. We'll go ahead and take a look at this date in history. On this date in 1999, teen gunmen killed 13 at Columbine High School. That occurred at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado, south of Denver. At approximately 11:19 a.m., Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris dressed in trench coats and began shooting students outside the school before moving into the building. On this date in 1971, Supreme Court declared desegregation busing constitutional. On this date in 1978, Korean Airlines jetliner was forced down over the Soviet Union. On this date in 1777, the New York State adopted its state constitution. In 1841, the first detective story is published. On this date in 1861, Robert E. Lee resigned from the U.S. Army after Virginia seceded from the Union. In 1914, a militia slaughtered strikers at Ludlow, Colorado. In 1689, in Great Britain, the Siege of Derry begins. In 1902, Marie and Pierre Curie isolated radium. In 2008, Danica Patrick becomes the first woman to win the Indy race. In 1980, Fidel Castro announces the Mariel boat lift, allowing Cubans to emigrate to the United States. In 2010, a massive oil spill began in the Gulf of Mexico. In 1986, Michael Jordan scored 63 points in an NBA playoff game. In 1898, President McKinley asked for a declaration of war against Spain. In 1871, the Ku Klux Klan Act was passed by Congress. In 1971, fragging was on the rise among U.S. military units. The Pentagon released figures confirming that fragging incidents were on the rise. 209 such incidents caused the deaths of 34 men. Fragging was a slang term used to describe U.S. personnel tossing fragmentation hand grenades, hence the term fragging, usually into sleeping areas to murder fellow soldiers. It was usually directed primarily against unit leaders, officers, and non-commissioned officers. In 1945, Operation Corn Cob was launched while Hitler celebrated his birthday. And that all took place on this date, April 20th. We'll go ahead and take a look at our weather forecast for the next 7 days or so to see what we have in store for us. On Wednesday, we'll have a high of 48, followed by a low of 28. The winds might be a touch gusty, getting up to 21 miles per hour. Thursday, mostly clear skies, a high of 60 with a low of 40 and a 30% chance of precipitation. On Friday, cloudy, 59, slight chance of rain. Friday night, low of 38. Saturday, partly cloudy skies, high of 56, gusts up to 24 miles per hour with the wind. Saturday night, looking at mostly clear skies, low temperature of 35 with wind gusts up to 22. On Sunday, warming up and still a little cloudy. High of 63, Sunday night, a low of 47. On Monday, mostly cloudy, looking at a high temperature of 77 degrees with wind gusts out of the south-southeast up to 26 miles per hour. Monday night, a low of 58 degrees with a slight chance of precipitation. On Tuesday, there's a chance of rain showers. Temperature bumps back up to 77 degrees under mostly cloudy skies. Winds will be gusty from 16 to 25 miles per hour. That's going to bring us to the end of the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Tuesday, April 20th. I'm Kevin Rogers at the microphone. Thank you so much for spending this time with me. Of course, this podcast and many other awesome podcasts are available to you at iowaradioreading.org. We thank you very much for your continued support of IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. Stay safe, stay healthy, take good care of yourselves, and we'll talk to you again right here on IRIS, bringing you the Fort Dodge Messenger with some help from the Webster County Daily Freeman Journal and the Marshalltown Times Republican. Bye-bye for now.
This is Jim Ralston with an Irish short take from the Book of Iowa Curiosities. Check out them checkers from Dubuque. Don Dwebar, creator and curator of the World of Checkers Museum, which also doubles as his apartment, is the special breed of collector who turns an obsession into a way of life. "I've gone without many meals just so I could buy books on checkers," he told me. "I'm what you call a bibliomaniac. I have over 2,000 checker books before I donated them to the Loris, a private college in Dubuque, and the Cleveland Public Library." While books on checkers are his first passion, or more accurately, his first monomania, he recognizes that they're not necessarily everybody's cup of tea. They're not the kind of book you read for fun, like Little Red Riding Hood. They're about checkers' strategy. Just descriptions, really, of what we call lines of play. From famous matches with an estimated 500 billion possible situations that could rise in a match. I'm not joking there. There's seemingly no end to checkers' strategy, nor the books that one could write about it. That's just fine with Dwebar, otherwise known as Mr. Checkers. Lee's Guide to the Game of Checkers was first published in 1897, and I had over 500 copies of that book, representing 127 different editions. Not many collectors would do that. Indeed, it's widely believed that his collection of books on checkers was possibly the largest and most certainly the most complete in the entire world. But Mr. Checker's passion for checkers didn't stop with books. Over the last 30 years, he's filled his tidy apartment with every checker set imaginable, made of everything from wood to bakelite to bone, as well as an impressive variety of checkers memorabilia. A kitchen cabinet, drawers, and even his refrigerator and stove have at one time or another been called into service as the World of Checkers Museum storage and display space. "Not to worry, you little fire marshals in training," Don said. He unplugged the stove and refrigerator first. And the best part is, his home and museum are open to the public for all to enjoy. "It's like the Mona Lisa," Mr. Checker said, of his museum. "You really have to see it to appreciate it. The Mona Lisa should be so lucky as to have a passionate and single-minded caretaker and roommate as Don Dwebar." If you feel like visiting Don and his World of Checkers, call 563-556-1944 or email him at checkers21@hotmail.com. That was an excerpt from Iowa Curiosities, Quirky Characters, Roadside Oddities, and Other Offbeat Stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.